ready to move on to another discussion by Pete Frank. Notice we're having Frank's before lunch. I don't know what the menu will be this afternoon.
In this session, it'll be fairly brief, in which we'll finish off the mission planning considerations and the effects of the constraints on trajectory shaping for the nominal mission. All we have left to discuss on this topic are the problems of getting the spacecraft back from the moon through the entry corridor and into the recovery areas. We don't have this break between the translunar and transearth phases in the mission trajectory design activities that we have here in the symposium. We must consider the combination of these two in order to come up with an overall mission, optimum mission. What we do in getting into the lunar orbit actually determines what we have to do to get back out of it and get back. So we cannot uncouple these things in our trajectory planning. Now, this discussion will be divided into two phases. There's a transearth and a reentry phase. And under the transearth phase, I'll be discussing the injection velocity requirements for that transearth maneuver and also where this injection will be located. And then this ties in very closely with the transearth coast phase, in which we find a fairly interesting combination here between the return perigee location and transit time effects. This slide just illustrates the velocity relationships between the spacecraft and the Earth and the Moon as it exits the Moon sphere of influence. This position vector represents some point on the sphere of influence at which we would be returning to Earth. And these vectors V sub R E are examples of two velocities that might be required to return to the safe entry corridor. Now, they're two extremes in that this one would correspond to a minimum energy type trajectory where we're essentially at an apogee condition. And we would follow this path returning to the safe entry corridor now, which is a perigee altitude of about 25 miles. This has a long transit time. And the other extreme that I've shown is a high energy trajectory. It still has a perigee altitude of about 25 miles, but the transit time now is much shorter. And the relative magnitude of these two velocity vectors then and their flight path angle or their orientation determine whether or not we do enter in the safe corridor, and they also control the flight time. This V sub M is a representation of the Moon's velocity vector relative to the Earth. So we have a little bit of a paradox here in that we have this kind of a velocity essentially while we're at the Moon, and we must increase our velocity relative to the Moon in order to escape. However, relative to the Earth, we have to reduce our velocity so that we'll fall back and return to the atmosphere. And these vectors shown here represent the velocity that the spacecraft must have relative to the Moon. And we can see that for any condition other than this one, where we're close to the minimum energy, we're going to require a greater magnitude of the escape velocity, or velocity at which we leave the sphere. And this is also true for the other situation. I don't have it shown, but you can imagine that there is a positive flight path angle that works just as well here. It's going to have a much longer flight time, but it would also require greater velocities vis-a-vis bar M, and that we would not have this zero flight path angle condition. So that the only point I want to make with this slide is that the faster return times do require greater exit velocities, and that I did also want to indicate that these are all essentially retrograde relative to the moon's orbit. And the faster the return time, the less retrograde that exit velocity is. Now this just illustrates the trajectory inside the moon's sphere of influence, and it relates that to the exit conditions. This is the moon in here, and this big circle represents the sphere of influence. These paths shown here are typical hyperbolic trajectories relative to the moon that we would employ to return to Earth. And I have two cases shown, the one corresponding to a slow return time, and this one corresponding to a fast return time, a high energy trajectory. Now, the magnitude of this velocity, this V sub rm, at which we exit the moon's sphere, is determined by the energy of this hyperbola, or the injection velocity we apply when we transfer onto this maneuver. That also has some control over the direction, but not nearly as much as the actual position of this injection. Now, we can control the direction in which we leave the sphere by adjusting the position in which we perform the maneuver. The end of these paths here represents where the maneuver would be performed, and that's essentially at the paralleling of that of each of the hyperbolas. So that, as I say, we control direction and magnitude simply by where we locate, where we perform the burn, and the amount of energy we put into it. And this indicates that for the very slow transit times that we would use corresponding to that apogee condition, now we won't be considering transit times that would pass through an apogee before returning to Earth. So that the injections will occur in this region that's shaded here. The Earth is down this way. And that's about 140 degrees west longitude is about the limit here, around from this point, and about the same over here. So that given any required flight time that we determine, we can find out the exit velocity that we need, and then where and how much delta V we must apply to come back to Earth. This slide just gives an indication of the magnitude of this maneuver as a function of flight time. And the two curves are shown, one for perigee and one for the moon at apogee. And you can see the trend, of course, that by taking the longer transit times, we do reduce the injection velocity requirements. You can also see that if we continue this slower and slower transit times, these curves are going to go back up and reflect that change in the exit velocity that we talked about. Now, the fact that these curves cross over here indicates there's other things working here other than just transit time, and that is the case. It's pretty complex, and I'm not absolutely sure I understand it myself, but I think that it's due to the fact that at perigee, the moon's velocity relative to the Earth actually is greater, and also that the being closer to the Earth, we get a higher attraction from the Earth's gravity. And these two effects are apparently dependent on the flight time that we employ, or the exit velocity direction that we use. Oh, this band of times that's indicated here that says this is the variation that's necessary to guarantee return to a primary recovery area. We'll get to that in just a moment. This slide indicates the geometry of this return trajectory. We're looking in the moon's orbit plane in this case, and here's the moon's antipode vector. And this time it's drawn at the time we perform this maneuver, or the time we leave the moon, so that by the time the spacecraft gets here, of course, the moon will have traveled on around. But this is the antipode we're concerned with, and that's in this case, and that's the one as we left the moon. As indicated here, there is a very definite angular relationship between this antipode and the perigee position. Especially for the range of flight times that we're interested in on this Apollo mission, there's very little variation in this relative position here, and it's sort of indicated by this shaded area, although that's slightly exaggerated. There's not that much variation. So this means then that inertially we're going to find the perigee here, and there's also a small variation between perigee position and where the landing occurs, and we'll see that in just a moment. But this means that inertially landing is going to occur somewhere in this region, and that's leads to a fairly interesting result, in that we know where the landing is going to be inertially. It's going to be somewhere in here. And our only problem now is getting the recovery forces in the right position, because they're sitting on this Earth and they're rotating around here once a day. So our problem then is to time this return trajectory so that the recovery forces have been rotated into the right position. And obviously this does occur once a day, and this leads to this statement here that any range of 24 hours variation in flight time will provide us with a solution. That is, we know that if we have a 24-hour range of flight times to choose from, there's one time in there when the recovery forces are going to be in the right position. And, of course, there is only one time. So all we must do then is determine when we're ready, or when we're going to be making the trans-Earth injection burn, look at where the recovery forces are, and if they're here or over in here, of course, then we must select different values of transit time. It should also be obvious that any increment, 24-hour increment in that transit time is also acceptable. Let me take one that's easy for me to read here. If we found that this 86 hours provided us with a rendezvous with the recovery forces, we know that some 24 hours later, or at 110 hours, we could also do the same thing. And we can control our landing longitude simply by adjusting the flight time, as would be indicated here. And this, we'll see in a moment, has a strong influence on our location of recovery areas. Okay, let's go on to the entry phase itself. The things we're going to discuss here real briefly are the entry corridor, the maneuver capability, and finally the location of recovery areas. I'm sure most of you, or everyone really, is familiar with the concept of the entry corridor. I just want to review it real briefly. It really defines the range of return trajectory perigee altitudes that will provide us with the safe entry conditions. And as shown here, we have an overshoot boundary, which is associated with the maximum return perigee altitude, and the undershoot boundary, which is associated with a minimum return perigee altitude. Now, on some definitions of this boundary, we actually do have the perigee altitude below the surface of the Earth. Of course, we don't fly that trajectory once you hit the atmosphere. These perigee And the difference between these two altitudes then represents our entry corridor. Now, there's another definition of the corridor, and that's also in terms of the range of flight path angles at this entry interface. And as shown here, this dotted line represents the atmosphere limit. And we can just as well define the corridor by measuring the flight path angle here and here. And that's generally a little bit easier to work with, since we do experience that flight path angle. And this overshoot boundary, then, is one that beyond which we could not guarantee that we can prevent a skip out the atmosphere. And we could apply, if we came in along this, say, a path up in here, we could apply all the negative lift we had available, and still we would not encounter a dense enough atmosphere to hold the vehicle down, and it would skip on back out. And on the undershoot boundary, we would realize excessive G-loads if we were to come in below this boundary. But even applying full positive lift all the way, we would dig down into the atmosphere so rapidly and so deeply that the G-loads would build up beyond the limits that we were placing. So that with these definitions of the corridor, we are using a 10G limit here. Well, I mean, this next slide then shows the Apollo entry corridor. Now, these are a function of the lift-to-drag ratio of the vehicle, the entry speed, and the actual atmospheric density. But for the nominal Apollo lift-to-drag ratio and this speed and the nominal atmosphere, we have the entry corridor plotted here, and it's in terms of both the flight path angle range at the entry altitude, and we also have it in terms of maneuvering range or downrange maneuver capability. We can see our skip out limit, as shown here, is approximately 5 degrees flight path angle at 400,000 feet. Our 10G undershoot limit is shown here as about 7.4 degrees flight path angle. And then there's another boundary shown here, a 20G emergency limit. This corresponds to the structural limitations of the spacecraft. So that this represents our nominal or operational corridor, and then this would be the extension that we can have for emergency conditions. Now, the range lines, this minimum guided range means that, let me take an example. Let's say at an entry angle of about 6 degrees, I could not bring the spacecraft down to a landing in less than something like 1,100 miles. That if the range from the reentry point to the landing were 1,000 miles, I'm going to overshoot the landing point. I just can't hold the range down below this value. And the significant point here is that at the overshoot boundary, this is about 1,500 nautical miles. This max range just represents the case where we applied full lift all the way through the reentry, and this is the maximum type range we could get. We can see that our maximum range is just arbitrarily cut off here at 2,500 nautical miles, that the vehicle has the potential of going way beyond that. Now, that's the purpose of that is to live within the heat shield capabilities. The heat shield is designed to fly a 3,500 nautical mile range as a maximum limit. Dr. Duncan mentioned the entry monitoring system that we have on board to ensure that we don't skip out beyond this type of range, and the fact that we have to build in a fairly large tolerance on this system in order to keep from causing the thing to take over when we actually were on a good trajectory. And it turns out that there's about a 1,000-mile tolerance in that, so that we cannot plan to use ranges in excess of 2,500 nautical miles. And this will keep our entry monitoring system then will not cause us to take over a good trajectory if we employ this as a maximum range. This leaves us then with an in-plane maneuver capability or a planned maneuver capability of from 1,500 to 2,500 nautical miles. This nominal aim point then represents the targeting conditions, both in terms of entry angle and range that we will apply for the nominal mission. And this point is about 6.2 degrees in flight path angle, and is 2,000 nautical miles in between the entry point and the landing point. This shows our total maneuver footprint capability on the map of the Pacific Ocean here. It's just a typical location. As we'll see in just a minute, we could be anywhere along in here. At the entry point we're here, we'll find that the 2,000-mile range going along this trajectory results in a nominal landing point at this position. However, we could guide the vehicle to any point within this landing area. This is our 1,500-mile point, and this is a 2,500-mile range. Now, the cross range at the heel of this footprint is about 440 miles, and at the toe out in here, it's about 660 miles. All right, now I'd like to look at some of the considerations that we go through in locating the recovery areas. This shows the geometry of the in-plane geometry of the reentry trajectory, and this being the entry point, and this is the perigee, that return trajectory, and the landing point located here. Now, this total angular travel here from entry to landing for the nominal mission, now for the nominal range, is some 33 degrees. That corresponds to our 2,000 miles. Now, there's a very fixed angular relation between perigee and entry, just due to the nature of the conic trajectory we return on. There's also a very fixed angular relation between entry and landing, again because of our maneuvering capabilities. And as was indicated over here on this other slide, there's a very fixed angular relation between this antipode and the perigee. So that this shows why the landing ends up being very close to the antipode position. Now, what this means in terms of our control of the landing capability can be summarized with this figure. All of these return trajectories, the various planes that we could select are going to return to this antipode, so that we find that this represents a node through which all of our reentry trajectories must pass. And this slide indicates that the change in inclination that we can make out here at this trans-earth injection point ends up providing us with some control over the landing point latitude, but not very much. This represents the locus of entry points here. And we are limited by how much inclination change we can make out in here, first by the amount of propellant we have to perform it with, and also by some constraints on the return inclination. So that you can see that our recovery problem is one where we've got fine control over longitude. All we have to do is adjust the time for the return to get the right longitude under this landing point. But we are faced with recovering at latitudes that are fairly close to this antipode position. Now, remembering now that during a given month, the antipode will travel from a latitude that's 28 degrees south up to 28 degrees north and back to 28 degrees south again in this 28 days. So that's an average travel of about 4 degrees per day. So this leads us then to the specification of recovery zones that are shown in this next slide. There are two zones, as we can see here, one north and one south. Now, this one is begins at a 35 degree north latitude and ends at about 5 degrees south. And it's centered roughly about 160 degrees longitude. Now, that recovery zone would be supported from forces staged at Hawaii, which is right about in there. The second zone begins and picks up at 5 degrees south and extends down to 35 degrees south. And its longitude is shifted over this way a little bit to be, because it will be supported from forces staged right in here. That's Samoa. And the reason we shift the longitude over is just to get it closer to Samoa, to try to reduce the range that the recovery forces must travel from their staging bases. The northern zone extends down into the southern latitude simply because we prefer to stage from Hawaii, and we're willing to travel a lot further from Hawaii if necessary in order to locate the ships at that base. For any particular mission, any specific mission, now we don't have to support all those recovery that total zone, of course, because on any given mission time, the latitude of the antipode is going to be located at some fairly fixed position in here. So for a specific mission, we end up with recovery forces located in some lesser spread of latitudes than is shown here. However, we can expect that they possibly would have to travel to any one of these positions. It just depends on when the mission occurs. We can, as indicated over here, perform plane changes to bring the latitude of the landing site in closer to the staging bases, and we will be doing this. The limitations, though, obviously, are just how much propellant we have available that we can budget for that particular maneuver. Might be interesting that for the current 504 mission plan that we're working on, we're finding that the moon is at northern declinations and the antipode is down in this position. And the recovery, it appears, will have to be performed from the Samoa staging bases. However, we do have, it seems we have quite a bit of propellant that we can budget for this plane change maneuver. And we will be making a fairly large azimuth change here and bringing the latitude of this recovery in fairly close to Samoa. That's completes my description of the constraints and the mission planning for this total mission. I would like to just make a couple of comments about how the trajectory design is performed. It's primarily done with the digital computers, and we've got programs that incorporate as well as possible all our operational constraints, so that we can just load these programs up with the current values of the constants or constraints that we're working to, and run through, let the computer design the trajectory for us. And its objectives are to minimize performance or propellant requirements, however, staying within these constraints that we've described today, and a lot of them that we haven't described either. Initially, these runs are made in a patch conic mode that scans all of the possible solutions, or not all of them, but the likely solutions. And with this kind of a procedure, we determine, grossly at least, the launch windows and fuel reserves to different landing sites. And then that data then is, we take that data back and study it and examine it and select then the ones that we want to use, the ones that look the most promising, and then we can go back into this program and rerun the precision integrated programs to actually determine our reference trajectories and the guidance targeting data for the mission. There's a very large amount of machine time and man hours involved in this process, and I sometimes think that's our biggest limitation. And you can imagine the multitude of trajectories that have to be run when you look at the variables we have to examine. There's variable launch azimuth, and every azimuth requires a complete trajectory to be run. There's multiple injection opportunities, and every injection opportunity means we've got to run the trajectory appropriate for that case. There's multiple launch days, so we've got that factor thrown in. Plus, there are multiple landing sites. And these don't add up, they multiply. So you can see the kind of a computing and data problem that we have to go through in designing these missions.
Thank you, Pete. I would just observe that that what you've seen in, I think, both of Pete's presentations is a pretty useful thing. Just because of the large utilization of digital computers involved in calculating the trajectories. And I think he's done, to my mind, a very good job in making it understandable, so the mumbo-jumbo that comes out of the computers has got some physical significance. Too often we lose sight of that when we play with those big computers. Okay, we have a little bit of time for discussion. Werner.
Could you make some comments on how the change in the landing area is linked to a possible slippage in the launch date? In other words, suppose we plan for a Tuesday launch, we have to scrub and take on a Thursday launch instead, 48-hour delay. Would it appear that people then select another landing site in the moon and another meridian on the moon, and as a result, their return trajectory will also be a different one, allowing for the 18-hour stay on the moon, and your landing site will therefore change as the kickoff date changes. Now, is it possible to move ships, the same ships, from the Tuesday re-entry date to the Thursday re-entry date, or do we have to depend on different ships because of the steaming time is too long?
I think in general that we would use the same ships, and the only reason I hesitate to say it completely because of where we would change zones. Now, there might be some problem there where
Hawaii versus Samoa.
Right, where we got into that situation. But
within the Hawaii thing, you can get the ships down to the...
Yes, that latitude of that antipode is, over the 28-day period, has got an average travel of about 4 degrees per day. And that's about 240-250 miles. I would suspect that they could keep up with that.
That's... Well, I agree with this connection. The point you were referring to as the antipode refers to a fixed cross-moon line and rotates with the moon's motion, right?
Yes, sir.
And the Earth is now spinning with respect to that axis.
Yes, sir.
Werner's questions were related to the recovery and the movement of the recovery forces. I'd observe that you've got 8 days of the mission time plus whatever the change of the launch date is to make that adjustment, so that you don't have to change your landing point in 2 days. You know about it at the beginning of the mission, and therefore you have, by and large, since we talked yesterday about launches every other day, not consecutive days, you got something like a 10-day lead time on where you would be coming back from a given mission. And that's enough steaming time, I think. Okay. Any more questions? Yeah, Bill.
What's the longest time you consider practical for between getting back into the
What's the question is, what's the longest time we consider practical between getting back into lunar orbit and trans-Earth injection?
I'm not sure, although I would suspect it'd be quite a long time that
I would observe that it's pretty much a function of mission, whatever you want to do in the mission. There's, as you know, some later missions in which Perhaps in addition to a lunar landing, there are things being done from orbit, in which case the orbital stay time is relatively open and up to the limit of the consumables. We're talking about only a couple or three orbits in the nominal mission we're planning here. I don't think it's very critical in terms of the mission plan, as long as you're not running out of consumables. Any more questions? Okay. I think we should break for lunch then. Let me suggest that we try to be back here at 1:30, which gives us more like an hour and 15 minutes. This afternoon sessions are also, I think, particularly interesting. The first one talks about aborts, and the second one talks about how the equations are actually mechanized to do all these good things that people say they can do so glibly.